Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health problem today. And RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
That's all that noise, you know, that's all that applause that's coming from my granddaughter, Claire. My mom hadn't been able to make it. She's 9 years old, almost 10. That's just one person in the audience. Huh? She loves her papa. Thanks, Claire. Thanks for the enthusiasm. Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. The unknown universe has been shrinking down. We had a workshop with Chris R. Some folks in the program know Chris. He goes around the world. He's a circuit speaker promoting one-on-one sponsorship. He's got a great message. I was there Saturday at the Delta. It's one of the AA groups here in Houston. Great message. He's got a great delivery. He goes back to the way it was when 50% got sober right away and the other 25% after a couple of relapses. That's what we're shooting for. That's what the high watermark looked like back in the day. So thank you, Chris, for all that effort and all that work. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse. Will forge us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. Thanks, guys. You know, they charge us, it's free, and that's really a good price, no matter how you cut the cake. They believe in what we're doing like we believe in what we're doing. You know, enthusiasm. Enthusiasm is the definition of a sale. It's the transference of enthusiasm. Is a sale. You're selling an idea. We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. We were supposed to get a February post out there, the 12 Steps to a Happy, Joyous, and Free Life. Really good post, really interesting, but I don't see it out there. They haven't come up with their February post yet. I don't know what's going on. It's almost March. But it's coming. They tell me, so is Christmas. I gratefully introduce my co-host, Harold B., a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families. And I personally believe the families are the basic unit of our society, the basic unit of our nation and the world. And as the family goes, so does our society. We have found that alcohol and drugs are component of families of children who were not taught correct principles. Once you teach a child correct principles, he can teach himself or herself. But until those principles are laid down, they have nowhere to learn. So what do we expect them to learn in school? Well, the schools are the collective point where all these children really don't know. So they learn from the gangs and the mean streets. And, of course, part of the rite of passage becomes drugs and alcohol, drugs, sex, and rock and roll. That hasn't changed in quite a few generations, except it's even more so now than before. So we try to address that. Harold addresses that with troubled families. He also goes to the prisons. And in the prisons, we find that most of the people in there are in there because of crimes of opportunity fueled by drugs and alcohol. Darn. So we're in epidemic proportion right now. Something like in the world, 2.5 million die every year from alcohol. It's 250,000 from pill overdoses, but totally it's 2.5 million, 10 times as many from alcohol. Alcohol kills more people than all the other drugs combined. Wow. That's not really what we were that interested in telling you that, because a lot of people want to say, no, it's heroin, and no, it's this, and no, it's that. No, it's alcohol. Alcohol is the number one killer 10 times. By 10 times, because it's so available. It's available. It's on every street corner. You know, some people drink with impunity, and then they find the conveniality of social interactions. It's a lubricant. For some people, it's a deadly poison. They can't take a drink, and if they do take a drink, they have the allergic reaction of craving. And it goes down, down, down. The denizens, they call it. And a lot of people would die, go to prison, go to jail, go to insane asylums before there was Alcoholics Anonymous. And reminder, we're not Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not AA, we're not NA, and we're not CA. We're Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is that's where nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. So, Harold, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Joseph. Thank you for that introduction. Yes, another interesting fact about alcohol, 9 out of 10 people don't have a problem. They can take a drink once in a while. They can predict where they'll end up. They don't have legal problems or relationship problems or employment problems because of alcohol. They don't have hangovers. They don't drink to get drunk. The other 1 out of 10 people do have those problems with alcohol, and the way that consumption is broken down is that 1 out of 10 people drink 90% of the alcohol that's consumed. The 9 out of 10 drink that other 10% of the alcohol that's consumed. So that kind of outlines the problem. And I'm so glad to be on the air and talking about how to really help people get recovery from addiction to alcohol, because a wonderful family that I've worked with for some time, one of the family members on Friday evening decided that she had battled long enough, and she swallowed a bottle of pills, and then prior to that she had been drinking. She had been drinking from Saturday to Friday, so about a week, after a 6 months of total abstinence. And prior to that she had been going to meetings. She had a sponsor. She'd been working the steps, but she decided that things were going well and she could stop calling her sponsor, and she could go to fewer meetings, and she could slow down on working the steps. And that's, as I see it, that's the only opening the enemy needs. He will move right in there, convince a person that they can, that alcohol would be a great solution to depression, whereas it's such a lie, because alcohol is a depressant. So when we're depressed, we shouldn't drink. And anyway, almost lost her life, she did have the presence of mind to call her husband. He dialed 911. They went over there, took her to the hospital, gave her the charcoal drink, and she managed to just scrape by. She's okay now, but it happens so often. So it's I am so grateful for my recovery and the people I'm working with, that the enemy is so tricky the way he says, oh, you're doing great. You should slow down on your recovery activities. So it's nice to be here and talk about back to basics and really do everything we can to help people that want recovery. Let me make a couple of little comments here about the program. I want our listeners to know that Joseph, nobody makes any money from the radio broadcast or the website, rumradio.org. This is done as a public service. It's our way of giving back for the huge, huge gifts that we've received from recovery and working the steps in our lives. So we do this as a public service. Let's see, what else? Would you like me to read
the phone numbers?
The phone number. Yes, it's 949-534-0621. Again, that's 949-534-0621. You can call in and ask a question. We also archive these programs, and there are about 2,000 listeners a week to the archives. So it's fun to be involved in this, and it has deep meaning for me. So I appreciate being here. Thank you, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. I'm going to do a little different. Usually we do the third step prayer to start off, but I think I'm going to do the how it works. You ever hear that, Harold?
Oh, I read that to my clients every week. Somebody hears that.
And at one time I was about 5 years in the program or several years in the program, and, you know, the meetings always start with how it works. In AA, I don't know about NA, but I take it they do something similar or the same. And I told my sponsor, I says, you know, why do we have to read that every time? I said, I've heard it 1,000 times already, enough already. He says, you know, it's still all about you, isn't it? No, we read it for the new person. Oh, okay. See, I always relate to the world around me, you know. Like, so here it is. It's how it works. This is found on the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's chapter 5. Page 58. Like I said, we're not AA, but the Big Book is the template of all 12-step programs. So I like to use the original template because that's the cleanest form of it, the original form. It's not written in a perfect vernacular. It has some archaic words in it, but it would spiritually enliven work. And you know how something spiritual, you know how you can, you know what the test is for something spiritual, Harold? You know what the test is?
What?
There's a big book fairy that goes out at night and puts stuff in the book that you've never seen before. And you'll go through the book and you'll say, when did they put that in there? The book, the information in the book will grow as you grow spiritually. More information will be made available to you. That's how you know if a work is spiritual. It'll grow with, as you grow spiritually, its understanding will grow spiritually. We grow spiritually, we also grow in effectiveness. And that's one of the tests. So here it is, how it works from the Big Book. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed up. There are those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been blonde that way. No, it says born. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length
to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness that our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us had tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go. Absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Made a searching and fearless moral, four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us, and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaim, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we set down are guidelines to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought.
And would if he were sought.
Yeah, that God could and would if he were sought. So you know what A, B, and C is, don't you? You see it? It's step one, two, and three.
A, B, C
is steps one, two, and three. It's right there. People say it takes a long time to get through the first three steps. There they are. We say it every meeting. Those are the first three steps. Right there. It's laid right out. That's how simple this program is. It's simple, but it's not easy. Well, that's enough out of me. Would someone else like to talk about me? All right. I'd like to introduce our host for tonight, Vic G. He's from the –
You're the host. He's the guest.
Did I say host?
You're the
host.
He's the guest.
Oh, okay. Well, I introduced the guest host. All right. I'd like to introduce our guest. Oh, I did say host, didn't I? Yes. No, I'm the host, right? Tell me. I'm the host. You're the host.
You're the host.
There you go. In the mouth of the second witness, the matter shall. The matter shall be established. Vic G is the guest. He's local, right here from Houston. We also call Houston Space City because of the Johnson Space Center. We launched the folks into the air. We shot a spaceship into the air. This is where we shoot them out from anymore, from Houston. So this is Space City. He's got a great story to tell. So how you doing tonight, Vic?
I'm doing great. Thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. So tell us what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and what keeps you to maximum service to God and your fellows. So when did you first realize that alcohol rang your bell?
I was in sixth grade. I had a can of Schlitz that I slammed down, and I kissed Shelley in playing Spin the Bottle. I knew I was in the right place.
Wow. Schlitz, that was the beer that made Milwaukee famous.
That's right. And it made
How many
feel
people
famous.
Remember that? Made you feel famous too, right? All right, so what happened? What now, your father drank Schlitz, it's in the fridge, and you decided, hey, that looks like fun. Let me grab one.
Well, I was at my uncle's, actually. We were playing. My parents were playing cards with my cousin's parents, and Shelley came over to visit. So we were out in the front yard playing, and we decided to play Spin the Bottle. So I had just finished sucking a can of hot Schlitz down. It was my first beer. And I got the nerve to give Shelly a kiss when we spun the bottle. So I felt like I'd really done something.
Bravery. So you got the bravery out of the bottle.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly what happened to me. I got bravery from a bottle.
And so you said, hey, there's something to this here. What's up with that? I didn't know it was that I had bravery on tap here.
That's right. And, so that was my first experience with drinking. And after that, I just, I didn't start really drinking again until I was probably in ninth grade. Then it got to be a weekend thing. And as time went by, I got to where I liked it more and more. And I eventually became a professional drinker. I was a bartender for about 8 years.
Well, there's time now. You went through high school. Did you bring the booze to school or any little sideline vignettes that happened at that time?
There was a couple of things. The first most important thing that happened to me when I was drinking at school was that I brought a bottle of wine to a Christmas party I threw for the art department at my school, and I got caught, and I got kicked out of school for it. And then my next big adventure drinking was at school was that we used to go down to I got kicked out of that school. So I got put into another school that I was zoned into. That was a magnet school. So that at the school I was zoned into, we lived downtown in Houston, and I was going to the school over off of West Dallas and called Lincoln. And so at lunch, me and the guys would go out, and we'd go down to the corner and get a fifth of malt duck and drink that at lunch. So that was how I fit in at that school. And then I got transferred to another school. And my first big adventure there with alcohol was we were doing Bye Bye Birdie. And I was the stage manager. So after our play at night, we went over for a cast party at a friend's house. And they had champagne, and that was my first bartending gig. I was making champagne punch, and then we had cocktails and beer all over the place. So I was drinking rum and cokes and drinking champagne punch. Needless to say, that was a disastrous combination. So I got a little sick on that, and I had a hard time making it to work the next day. In fact, that might have been the first job I lost drinking.
How old were you at the time now?
17 by now.
Oh boy, 7. Okay.
Now, of course,
and you were running
drinking,
the show. You were running stage production.
Yeah, I was the stage manager. That's right.
It's pretty impressive at 17.
Well, it was just a student production. Now, at the same time, of course, I'm running around with a bunch of guys, and we're drinking and all this kind of stuff. I mean, I've gotten to where I like alcohol at this point. And Let's see. What happened
did
to
you make
next?
You got college in there or no? Did you skip that?
Well, I did go to college for a while. And, in fact, it didn't work out for me very well. I liked drinking more than I liked going to class. So that ended up getting me in some trouble there too. But I kept drinking. I drank for 22 years to get drunk.
Alcoholically.
And at the end of that, alcoholically, yes. Drinking for effect.
Any DWIs?
Get drunk.
Any DWIs or DWIs?
Okay, not in high school. I did not get any in high school, but I guess about the time I got to be about 28 or 30, I started getting pulled over. And by the time I started, I got my first DWI around 30. And then I started getting DWIs pretty regularly after that. You know, it's kind of like you're lucky for a while, and then all of a sudden you're not lucky anymore. Well, I had lost my luck.
I had a similar experience. That was later on for me when I got my first DWI. Well, I only got one, so I say first one, one and only. And the cop told me at the time. I said, "How did you know?" Because I was driving slow, but I went to change lanes to get in the right-hand lane to look a little bit less suspicious, right? Because I was driving below the speed, and somebody came speeding up on the right, so I swerved back, and then that's when the cop pulled me over. And I said, "Well, why'd you pull me?" He says, "Well, you swerved across the line." I said, "Well, there was another car coming." He says, "Yeah, I didn't see that." He says, "But don't worry about it." He says, "At that intersection, 80 or 90% of everybody at this time of night on a Saturday night is DWI. So it's basically fielder's choice. You just got caught." Oh, okay. So that was the first. He said, "The chances of you getting a second DWI was 85%.
Yes. Well, that's right. So I was a bartender for a long time. In fact, a cop had told me at some point that after 10 o'clock at night, as far as they're concerned, everybody on the road is drunk.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And, that's just the way they look at it. So I got my first DWI and up in Colorado, and then I got my second and third DWI here in Houston. And I never breathed in a tube for them, so I never really got convicted. But, you know, big deal. I was a mess.
So where are you in life now? You got a job? Are you working? Did you get married? You got kids? What are you, still single? What's that happening?
Well, in fact, I like to be a single person. I like to be a bachelor. And I was a bachelor until I was 48 years old.
Wow.
And then I thought maybe I was missing something, so I thought maybe I should get married. And then I found that I wasn't missing anything when I did get married, so there you go. But
was she a drinker too?
You know. No, actually, she had migraine headaches, so she didn't drink much.
Was the alcohol the reason for the breakup, or you just didn't like the company?
I don't think the drinking was the big cause of our breakup. We had some other issues going on. I'm not able to deal with issues very well when I'm drinking, but I wasn't stupid. I just liked drinking, and I knew I was running out of luck because I was getting pulled over a lot. So I tended to drink more at home, and, it's not that hard to figure out if you're an alcoholic. In fact, I used to drink with a bunch of people, and I told them, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they didn't like that. they didn't like that I was impugning them. They thought that was telling them they were alcoholics. So,
Yeah, show me your friends and I'll tell you who you are. Well, we've taken a big jump. Okay, so you're in high school. You tried college, but drinking was more – you wanted to get a Ph.D. like Dr. Bob in drinking. Where are you now? So you're in, what, early 20s?
I'm in the early 20s. I'm living in Austin, having a lot of fun, and didn't get in any real trouble there. You know, I got in some other trouble there, but nothing about drinking. So,
well, you're working though, right? You got a job. What are you doing?
Well, I started bartending in Austin, and I dropped out of college because it was getting in the way of my drinking. And then I started working in bars, and I worked in four or five bars around town. And then a bar I was working at caught fire, and I couldn't find as good a job anywhere. About that time, my brother said, "Why don't you come down to Houston and work with me, and I will teach you how to do something real, like be a carpenter." So I did. I came down here to Houston to be a carpenter, and I was busy with that for about several years working for him, and meanwhile I had gotten somebody pregnant, so I had taken a job that had insurance. I wasn't going to marry the lady, but I was going to help her. I was going to give her child support and insurance, health insurance, and this kind of stuff. So my drinking was getting real bad, and I was about to get fired from this job, and it was not a great job. It was just a carpentry job. I was making wooden bridges around the city of Houston for the city. So I was cutting creosote with a chainsaw for a living. And and I cut some fingers off on a saw one morning. So
ooh.
Were
you drinking?
I had been drinking the night before, yeah. I was hungover. I was angry. My helper wasn't giving me much help. So I was mad. And so to show him what for, I cut my hand, cut the ends of my fingers off.
I'm gonna show you.
That's right. So anyway, you know, it was just an accident at work, and what I ended up doing was going into physical therapy because I couldn't work with my fingers damaged like this. So, you know, the way it is when you're drinking, things start to slip away. You know, I mean, I had ended up in this pretty crappy job, and I was in a lot of trouble there. And I ended up cutting my fingers up, which gave me some free time off. But when I went back to work, another thing had slipped away, and that was the ability to wake up after staying out drinking until 2 o'clock in the morning and get up at 6. And I started sleeping through my alarm. And so I called up on November 20th of 1992, at about 7:05, I called my boss, and I said I wasn't coming in that day, or I was late, and I couldn't come in. He said he'd noticed that. And he said, what's going on with you? And I said, so I think I got a drinking problem. He said, well, I noticed that, too. What are you going to do about it? I said, well, I'm going to go to AA and get a desired chip today and see if I can quit drinking.
Ah, so keep him quiet, right? Yeah, you're going to...
I was serious. I really wanted to quit drinking. So I stuck with it, and I did go to get a desired shift, and it did keep me sober. So I have gotten one desired shift, and I went to a noon meeting at the Delta Club, and I had a funny thing happen to me there. I was getting that desired chip, and you know, I had owned that alcoholism. I was proud of my alcoholism, and I could see the thing slipping away, but I just loved drinking so much, and So I got into that meeting and I wasn't sure if this could work or not. I mean, I was desperate, but I wasn't sure if it could work or not. And what I did was I walked in, I got the desired chip, and it was like the weight of my alcoholism was lifted off my shoulders at that moment. And I was impressed. I mean, I didn't understand it, but I knew – I didn't understand it, but I knew it had happened. You know what I mean? And
grace. In other words, you would say that was grace. You all of a sudden you felt grace, right? You don't know what happened, but
I did.
You know,
I breathed in the good air. That's right. I breathed in the good air, and I didn't have to drink anymore. Now, I didn't know I didn't have to drink anymore. All I knew is that when I went in to get that desired chip, something happened, and I did not I did not feel like myself. You know, I mean, I felt good about not drinking anymore. And I had no idea the journey I was getting ready to take off on, but I definitely felt that, and I was impressed.
You know, we have a lot of folks in the program say, well, how did you get sober? And they'll say, well, I got grace, right? And through grace I did it. And it makes it sound like you didn't do anything. And so I take an exception to that. I believe we're saved by grace after all that we can do. Not after all that we can talk, not after all that we can think, and not even after all that we can pray. The magic words in AA is action and more action, for faith without works is dead. And anytime I see anybody who's gotten well, they've taken a particular action at a particular time. It might have just been getting down on their knees and asking God. It might have been walking into a meeting. But they took some kind of physical action, and then the grace comes. What do you think?
Well, I walked up there and I got that chip. Nobody was holding my hand. I walked up to the front of the room and I got the dessert chip. And at that moment, I wasn't interested in anything about purposes or anything like that. I was just, what I was most impressed about was the fact that I didn't feel like I had to go get a drink when I left. You know, I was out there. I wasn't working. I was off for the day. I'd gone and gotten this dessert chip. And I just went home after that meeting. And my boss called me up a little bit later, and he wanted me to go to my EAP, you know, the Employee Assistance Program. So he wanted to put something in my file, you know. So I called him. I said, okay, I'll do that for you, boss. I'll call him. And, of course, I had used up all my sick time and all my vacation time and every possible day off. And if I missed work, I was on dock, you know. So I called him, and they said, well, that they could see me any evening way down in Clear Lake area. And I said, don't you have anything in town? And they said, well, yeah, we do, but it's going to be 24 days before there's anybody at that office that can see you. And I said, that's good. I'll take that one. So I did. That's what I did. I took that appointment, and it was 24 days later, and I went to a meeting every day. Sometimes I went to two or three meetings a day, and I just hung in there until I could get to that place. Now, meanwhile, I'm listening to these people talking, and I'm not a stranger to AA. I've got a grandfather that sobered up intermittently, and I had a mother that sobered up and stayed sober. But I was never interested in sobering up, so, you know, it didn't make much difference what they did to me. But what I saw was that people were staying sober. It was working for them. And I was impressed. So I decided what I needed to do was figure out how these guys were doing it. And I was going to the Post Oak Club and some to the Delta Club. So I just kept going to meetings, you know. And sometimes I'd go to one or two a day, sometimes three a day, like on the weekends and stuff like that. Place to hang out, something to do, you know. And, you know, I didn't drink. So I had all these guys come up to me and say, I want to be your sponsor and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, you know, I don't want you to be my sponsor. I'm not sure that I'm interested in that yet. I didn't know what I wanted. I didn't know how the thing worked. You know, I was not drinking, and that was the important thing to me at that moment.
Let's go back a little bit. Let me interject this. A lot of folks don't realize when a real alcoholic, and we say that with kind of tongue-in-cheek, what real is and what really is that we really don't know, but we say that, I guess it's a form of ego to impress people, but when an alcoholic decides not to drink, and this happened with me, so I'll talk it from my personal experience, is that it seems almost impossible to think of never having a drink again. Never to get high again. It's like monumental. It's like crawling, like looking up at a mountain, like I'm never going to do this again. So the first thought is, well, maybe I can get well enough where I can drink like regular people. But never to get that ease and comfort, never to get that buzz on again, seems like, why? Why would you live life
How can you live life? How could you? How can you go fishing without a beer? How can you drink spaghetti and meatballs? How can you eat spaghetti and meatballs without a glass of wine? Or if you're with people and they're drinking, what are you gonna? How are you gonna deal? I could just do it a little, but never to do it again. It just seemed like I just couldn't wrap my head around. Never.
Yeah, I agree.
Does that happen to you?
That's right. And also, yes. I mean, actually, I was there to quit for good. For once and for all, I knew that I knew what drinking did, and I couldn't function drinking. And I knew about the craving. I mean, I understood that immensely. I knew that there was no telling. You know, if I'd have a business appointment after work to go sell another job or something, and I'd go to the bar and I'd never make it. I knew what it was costing me, you know. So that wasn't a big mystery to me. But nevertheless, the whole concept of what AA is going to do functionally and all this kind of stuff, I didn't want anybody running my life. And I was a little bit, not scared of that, but I just wasn't that interested in what that had to offer me at that point. So I had
something else you had mentioned I wanted to address. Now, the big book says, and we never go, we don't hear it much, but it's in there. It says, go find a prospect and start working on them. And it also relates to the fact that if you approach somebody and they're not interested in what you have, go find someone else who's desperate enough to accept what you're giving them. Now, we don't hear that in AA. I heard when I was coming up that if someone approached you to be your sponsor, you didn't walk away from them, you ran away from them. And I thought that's the way it was supposed to be. I'm supposed to have some kind of connection with this guy or whoever to sponsor me. So I just go to a lot of meetings waiting for that moment of connection. It sounds a lot like dating. You know what I mean? I'm going to find this one sponsor that's going to fulfill me, you know? And that's sort of the mentality. You know, like, I believe that when they first come in and you get a beginner's chip, you're hot, you go get him. Go get the guy. If he turns you down, that's okay. But at least you make the attempt to sit down with him and be his sponsor. What do you think of that?
Well, I do agree with you to some extent there. That's what I was looking for when I walked in. I was trying to find this guy that was going to lead me out of here. And I hadn't run across him yet. So meanwhile, I'm going to meetings for 24 days before I get into this treatment program. And I'm not a stranger to it in that I have met people in AA, you know, out of my family, and I knew that it worked for them, but I didn't know anything else about it except the fact that it worked for certain people, and I had seen some people that had made a profound difference in their lives. So, but I had never tried to sober up before, so that was a completely different deal to me. I didn't understand it, and I didn't have any opinions. I just knew that the day I got the desire chip, I wasn't drinking after that. What it meant, what was going to happen with me, I didn't know. So what I did was I avoided these guys that were going to sponsor me, and I just kept going to meetings. And it was holding off. You know, I was going in, I was breathing the good air, and when I left, it kept me going. And sometimes I'd go in, like I said, two or three times in a day if it was on the weekend. I didn't hang out in the halfway measures room. I didn't just hang out there, but if there was a meeting going on, I'd go for a meeting. After the 24 days, I got called in for this appointment at this treatment place. So
let me stop you right there just for a second. Hold that 24 days. I came in and I was going to get it the same way. I didn't get the sponsor. I had a sponsor and then didn't work up and then just depended on the meetings. And I heard Danny B says this all the time. I'm going to get this program through the process of osmosis. If
I sit through enough meetings, enough AA or NA, enough recovery meetings, that the message is going to come through the floor, up my chair, up my butt, and into my head. And I'm going to get this through osmosis. And what I found is, after long-term sobriety, was that I might be sober, but I'm not in recovery, which makes all the difference. But I didn't know that at the time. So go ahead. You got the 24 days.
I got the 24 days, and I start the treatment program. So they said that this is going to take, you know, some time, that they weren't going to lock me up because I had the 24 days of sober. I had detoxed. I hadn't had a drink in the 24 days. So I was pissed, and then the guy said, look, you know, we're going to teach you some tricks, but what's really going on is what you're getting out of AA is what's going to save you. And I began to realize that by going to the meetings. I'd heard people talking. You know, and so it wasn't a giant mystery. And then he started teaching me some things, and he taught me some great tricks in a, you know, in a group therapy session. And I went to those three times a week for about 6 weeks. And some nights we'd go to AA meetings, and some nights we would just circle up in his office and have our meetings there. And, you know, I was good. I was breathing the good air, and, you know, everything was working for me, and I was happy, and I wasn't drinking. And at the end of 6 weeks, they said, look, we're gonna cut you loose from this, and if you'll get a sponsor, we're going to hook you up so that you don't have to come but one day a week. So I still hadn't quite figured out about there not being any angles left in life. So I called a guy up that I knew that lived about 20 miles away in Angleton, 30 miles, 40 miles, 50 miles away in Angleton. He was an old AA guy that I knew. And he said, well, yeah, I'll be your sponsor. But he said, but Victor, I live, I'm not going to call you long distance and blah, 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 this, that, and the other. And I said, just say you'll be my sponsor. I got to have a sponsor. He said, okay, I'll be your sponsor.
I need a sponsor name only.
I need a sponsor name. So he said, I'll do it. You know, okay, I'm doing it. And I guess I didn't even get back to my next session, and I realized that something was going on here. I was looking for an angle, and there was no angles left. So what was I going to do instead? So I had been listening to a guy over at the Post Oak Club that I liked what he said, and I walked up to him the next day, and I said, hey, will you be my sponsor? He said, yeah, sure. He says, I've only got, you know, so much time. I said, that's all right. I just need a sponsor. I like the things you say. We had drunk in the same places, but he was a different guy than me. He was a River Oaks lawyer, and I was a Montrose freak, you know. And
What was his first name? I might know him.
Jimmy B. He lived in River Oaks, and now he's out in West Houston.
Jimmy. He's a cop, though. Okay.
No, this is a older fella. So what Jimmy told me was, look, I haven't ever sponsored anybody. I've only been sober a couple of years. I've never sponsored anyone.
Mm.
He said, but my sponsor has taken me to a big book study. And he said, you know, there's something about this meeting that I really like. So I want you to start going to that meeting with me. And I said, okay. And it was in my neighborhood in the Heights. So I went. And it was amazing. They sat down, they read the step at the beginning of the meeting, and one person would chair for 12 weeks. There was a discussion meeting at each end, and they doubled up on some steps in the middle. And like 6 and 7 were doubled up, and I believe 8 and 9 were doubled up.
Sure.
So these guys didn't talk about, they didn't read the 12 and 12, they didn't read the big book. They read the step out of the big book, and then they shut the big book, and they started talking about how the step had worked in their life that day, or that week, or just a minute ago. And all of a sudden, all that stuff, and I've been reading the big book, and you're right, new things pop up in there all the time. How can they cram more words in there? So,
really?
Wow, these guys are bringing this stuff to life. And there was guys like me that just were new, and there were guys that had a couple of years. There was a guy in there, Tom N., that had over 40 years at the time. That was 20 years ago, 21 years ago. So Tom would have had 61 years by now if he's still alive. I don't know. He's one of the early pioneers, I believe, in town. I think he was hooked up with the Montrose Group, which became the Gulf Coast Club.
Yeah, I know what that is.
But I don't really know the history, but I've seen Tom in other literature since then, and I think he's probably the guy. He'd been sober forever. And these guys just turned me on. I couldn't believe it. It was amazing. And all of a sudden, all the stuff I was reading in the book began to make perfect sense. And I was impressed. So they had a thing that they believed in. They said, if you haven't done the step, we're not interested in speculation, so you can just sit there quietly. And so the first few meetings I went to, I was quiet. And I got to the third step, and I had taken my daughter down by the – my daughter stayed with me on the weekend. And I took my daughter to the SPCA to see if we couldn't find a puppy or a kitten or something for her. We couldn't find anything we liked. But there sure was a cute chick working behind the counter.
So there
I took
you
my
go.
Daughter home. She was about two. I put her down for a nap. Maybe 3 years old by now. No, I guess she was about two. That's right. I sobered up when she was two. So I take her back home and after Sunday school we go to the SPCA after Sunday school and then we go back home and my mom is there. She lived with me. So I let her watch my daughter while I put her down for a nap. So I'm going to go to the grocery store, and I got a thing to stop out on the way. So I wrote this little girl a note, dropped it off, and she read it, and she laughed. And we were having a good time, and she said, well, look, I'm kind of busy here today, but, come back during the week. I'm not so busy, and it'd be great. We can talk. I said, okay. So I came back the next day on Monday, and I walked in, and she was in there, and I said, hey, how's it going? She said, oh, great. She's laughing. So she said, looking for a dog still? I said, yeah. She goes, well, go look in the kennel. So I went in the kennel, came out. She wasn't around, so I went and looked in the cat room. There wasn't any kittens I wanted either, and I came back out. She still wasn't there. So I thought, yeah, maybe this isn't working very well. So I decided, I'll just leave. That's cool. Well, there was a guy standing in the lobby, and somebody was standing by the door with their keys, so I guess they were ready to close up. So I said, I'll get out of here. Let me get out of y'all's way. I'm going to leave. So the woman that was at the door follows me outside, and she says, are you Vic? And I said, yeah, I am. She says, quit harassing my employees. So I said, oh, okay. So I got in my car, and that was the day of the step study. That was the Mondays were the day of the step study. So got in my car, and I pulled out on Montrose, Studimont, and if I took a left, the step study was down there, and if I took a right, Rudyard was down there. So I took a left, and I got to the meeting, and I told the guys about that, and before the meeting started, I was talking to them, and I told them what had happened. So they said, well, you really are sick. You're going to go down and tell her how sick you really are? And I was like, no. So at the end of that meeting, my sponsor and I had worked the first couple of steps, and I was trying to decide if I was ready to make a go of it. So he heard the story, and he said, I think we need to do the third step for today, Victor. I said, I think you're right, Jim. So after the meeting, we got down in front of God and all those grown men and did the third step prayer, and then I started jumping into the steps. So he said, go home and do your fourth step, and we'll do your fifth step next week. And I was kind of quick. So I've been around for a little while, Jimmy, and I think that's kind of fast, isn't it? And he goes, oh, you've been hearing people that haven't done their fourth step, huh? I said, yeah, I've been listening to a lot of these people, and some people have waited years to do their fifth step. He said, what makes those people stick in your mind so well, Victor? And I said, I guess what makes them stick in my mind is how messed up they really are. And he said, that's right. So which one do you want to be? So I said, I'll go home and work on my fourth step. And, he was right. What do you say? He was right. So I went home and worked on my fourth step, and I showed it to him a week later, and he said, no, Victor, I didn't ask you for a blame list. I asked you for a fourth step. So what's your part in it? And I had also decided after I was doing my fourth step that I need to get in a cab with somebody, or what did I need to do? You know, who was I going to do this fifth step with? And I wasn't so sure I'm doing it with my sponsor. But then I realized that one of my big problems was that I just didn't trust people. And it was time to make the leap. So it was into action, and I got with my sponsor, and he said, it's not a blame list. I'll give you another week. Figure out your part in these things. And I started reading the books and worked on my fourth step and got it right. And we got together a week later and did my fifth step. And when I had done my fourth step, you know, I guess doing that third step had put my back against the wall in that fourth step, you know. And I was trying to stall around, and he wouldn't let me do it. And I did stall around anyway because I did it wrong. But I realized at that point that that I needed to get busy with this stuff. So after we did the fifth step, you know, we started talking about six and seven. You know, we got your patterns and behavior here. What are you going to do? And I said, I guess you do seven on them, huh? He said, that's right. You got to start changing them. So I did that, and then we got my list together of people I needed to start making amends to, and I started making amends. And about the time I got to that, I was more than caught up with the group, and I started sharing at the meetings, within that first 12-week period, I had gotten through the steps and was working them, and I had these guys coaching me about what the steps were and what it meant in real life, in real day terms, and it was, you know, it came to life for me. They really showed me what this thing was about. I was really impressed, and I no longer had to go to three meetings a day to get what I needed out of AA.
So, and then you had the eighth and ninth. You had no problem with making your amends, going to the to the people that you've hurt.
Well, you know, I mean, I was ready to make amends to everybody. So, you know, I had the $50 in my pocket walking in the street. Somebody was walking, and I owed him $50. I didn't cross the street. I paid him what I owed him. And you know, there's a lot of the old sweethearts you don't need to talk to, but there's one I had been especially rude to and had been rather obsessional about, and I had to call her to clear the air, make friends with her again. And you know, your family amends, you know, just quit drinking and be here for us. And I was, and I ended up getting custody of that girl, that child, and I raised her. And when my mother moved in with me, I mean, I was still drinking when she moved in with me. She had gotten into some economic trouble, and I had taken her in. So, you know, I was doing what I needed to do to my family. And I had made amends with my brother, who I'd had some grudges against over the years. So, you know, I was rocking along with this stuff, and it was working. You know, I mean, I was listening to these guys every week talking about how it works in their lives. It wasn't like you go do the steps and then you go back to doing what you're doing until you get caught, you know, and then you have to go do something again. These guys weren't doing that. They were doing it all every day. And I understood that. And many years later, I talked to Jimmy, and I said, Jimmy, was I just new to this stuff, or was that really something else? And he said, Victor, that was a moment in time. And that they got mad at the pastor over there at the All Saints Church in the Heights and left the room and took it out to the Holy Name Retreat for a period of time. And then they got mad at the Holy Name Retreat, I guess, or whatever. The group is now, the contractors group is over at the Methodist Church on West Timer now, and in Buffalo Speedway. But I went by there the other day, and there was some young guys leading it, and they were letting people give speculation. So I realized that it wasn't the same meeting that it used to be. But I've taken that step study. I've gone all over the world working, and I've taken that step study with me wherever I've gone. And there's really only a couple of meetings that really interest me anymore, and those are beginners' meetings and step studies. I like to get together with the aficionados and see how it's working, how it works. I'd like to get there for the beginner and tell them that it works and just keep coming back. So I've gone to step studies in all these different towns I've lived in, and, you know, they do them different ways, but basically they get the 12 and 12 out and read the 12 and 12, and then they share a little bit about the step. And after the first few times, of me talking whenever they had this meeting, one of them would always come to me and say, "You always talk about how you were working the steps like today or yesterday or this week." And I say, "Well, that's because that's what I did." And I've been asked to, "Will you lead this for 12 weeks and take us through the steps?" So I've taken that contractors meeting around the world with me.
Oh, that's cool. Very good.
It's a real testament to what those guys were about, I think. I've always been real happy for that, you know.
Did you start a group here? Had you started a new group here? I thought you started a new group in Houston, didn't you, or no? Inner City group?
Yeah, I did start a group. I started a group here. It's called the Primary Purpose Group.
Oh, okay.
That was in the Montrose area. That was in the Montrose area when we started it. The purpose of it was that it was tough to find a meeting in the Montrose because they were all over the place. They were in churches and they were just all over the place. You never knew where you were going to find a meeting in the Montrose. I mean, well, you knew, but you had to have the guide or the meeting guide because it's going to be in a different church or a different room every day. And the only exception to that was the traditions room, which had meetings on Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday. It was in a house, and their concession to the neighborhood was that they would only have meetings 3 days a week. The history of it was a house that belonged to an AA guy whose family had passed, and he was a paraplegic. He'd been a member of the Montrose group when the Montrose group was in the Montrose. But they moved out to South Post Oak because they ran a poker game all the time to pay their way and to do that instead of drinking. So they moved out way out to South Post Oak, and they got a place that had a driveway about a quarter of a mile long or half a mile long, and they could always spot if they had a poker game going, they had somebody out on there watching. And if the sheriffs drove up, they would ring a bell, and by the time the sheriffs could get into the building, they had all the tables turned back over, and they were just sitting around drinking coffee. So that was that's a true story.
I know. Alcoholics are definitely creative and when it comes to trying to come in through the back door on anything. I believe
well,
that.
Well, these guys had their problems, but they felt like if they were dealing with the alcoholism, that was a good start. And, they dragged money out of the pot for all those houses. The Heights group did that until just recently, as a matter of fact. That's another old room. It's from the 40s. And then Montrose group was doing it. I don't know if LaBranche group ever did that, but that's the other old group in town.
Oh,
but
good.
Yeah, Montrose Group and Heights Group both had a sponsorship game going all the time.
So you sponsor now? Are you sponsoring
well,
now?
I do. I don't ever know where I'm going to be in a week or two because of the way I work. But what I have found is that there's something I can do with everyone. And what I have tried to do most recently is take people through the steps in the day. You know, they've got a sponsor and they're new. And I'll tell them, look, I don't know how long I'm going to be here. I could be here today and I could be in Nicaragua tomorrow. But today I got a day off. And I'd like for us to sit down and go through the steps in a day. It would take us about 4 or 5 hours. But I don't want you to die waiting to figure out how this deal works. If your sponsor wants to do a step a month, he's not going to die, but you might. So I take these guys through the steps, and I show them, you know, what I basically believe, and that's that it's honesty, open-minded, and willingness at different levels. And, I believe that's true. I believe honesty, open-minded, and willingness is 1, 2, 3, and you're ready to start doing the stuff. And then the honesty is to, you know, I told the truth to myself, I'm an alcoholic, and now I tell the truth to myself, these are my character defects. The open-mindedness was I came to believe in the action steps that I told somebody. And then making the decision to turn my life over to the program, to God as I understand him, well, that's recognizing my character defects and then asking God to remove them from my way, you know, to take these things from me. So those are combined, but that's the willingness part. And then I think 8 and 9 is I'm honest. I'm going to be honest to you what I did to you. And 9 is I'm going to make it right. And, you know, that's justice. And then I think honesty, open mind, and willingness is just the basis for 10. And then, you know, 11 and 12, I believe, are just the kernels and the reward of the program.
Yeah, I like to think 10, 11, and 12 are the spiritual growth steps. You know,
yes,
it says that our sobriety is based on the maintenance of a daily spiritual condition. So my argument is what maintains itself of itself. And I found nothing, but even the sun's going to extinguish in its day. You're either growing spiritually or you're declining spiritually. And if you're declining spiritually, your recovery and then even your sobriety becomes tentative. So my experience is step 10 is steps 4 through 9 in the present, taking it as a single package. 10 is really critical, I think.
I would have to admit that I agree with you completely on that. I have a saying that I use, and that's that I'm ruthlessly positive and I'm relentlessly optimistic. another thing that I like to say is that I'm like a shark. You know, if I stop trying to be sober, you know, a shark can't stop. He's got to keep moving all the time to stay alive.
Right.
So
he can't stop.
I just sound like a shark. I can't stop. You know, I've got to keep going with this stuff all the time.
That's a good analogy. I'm glad to hear that you have the ability to take someone through all 12 steps in 24 hours. Matter of fact, I don't know how you noticed that, but we have 4 videos on the rumradio.org website that shows you how to do that.
Yes,
there's
well,
four
I,
videos
that's
that
some
come,
of the stuff I was taking a peek at. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Michael M. out of Chicago did the videos, and then he allowed us to put it on the website. It goes back to YouTube, and then he had written that section, Dr. Bob times 5,000, 12 and 24, Dr. Bob and 5,000, because Dr. Bob is credited with sponsoring 5,000 guys. Actually, it's the 5,000 who went through Akron Hospital. Whether you consider that a sponsor or not, but he worked with 5,000 alcoholics back in the day. So it was done very quickly. They did the surrender, and usually the whole thing was done in a couple days, no more than 2 weeks. And at the time, it was 50% got well right away, and the other 25% after a few relapses. That was a 75% success rate. Doesn't look like nowhere like that today, and I believe part of the problem is that we've dragged out the process. Once you get them through the steps, you get them through the steps, and you get them working with another alcoholic. The one immunity we have from alcoholism is intensive work with another alcoholic. This activity works when other activities fail, and we could start slowing down the spin-dry cycle of the revolving door. But until we start pushing it back the way it used to be like and get rid of the jargon from the rehabs, you know, everybody come say, you know, the rehab, you know, rehab jargon and the way they do that. But when you point it out to them because they got sober this way, who are you to tell me how this thing works? Work your own program. You're going to hear that quite a bit. Anyway,
well,
you got anything in? Yeah, go ahead.
When we first started at Primary Purpose, I used to have a meeting that I called Happy Hour. And it was on Friday afternoons. It was an aficionados meeting. And what the rule was that you could only talk about how the steps were working in your life. You couldn't piss and moan about anything. You could only talk about what success you were having with AA. And I did it like the gong show.
That's a great idea.
Oh, and the other thing that I said was no program speak. If you speak as if you're coming out of a treatment center, if it's program speak, I'm going to gong you and I'm going to move on to the next guy because we're not interested.
Really? Good idea.
I'm hardcore about this stuff. So for an afternoon meeting that was kind of off the books, it got pretty popular, and I had a good crowd of people coming in. And I had a lot of fun with that. And part of my purpose was always kind of a bus stop place. You know, I mean, it was there's a lot of bus stops in Houston. There's a lot of treatment centers in Houston. So I would get these guys coming in from the Men's Center and from across the street at Right Way and all that kind of stuff. And they kind of liked me being tough with people, you know, and gonging them and stuff like that. I thought that was pretty funny.
Sure.
But the reality was I wanted them to understand that this stuff's going on in the real world. This is not some, you know, you're not getting
abstract.
It. You're not getting it. We're not living on the abstract plane. We're living right here, right now. So talk about it as if you were talking to somebody walking down the street. And, you know, it went a long way, and I had a great time with that. Now, I stopped that meeting after a while. Nobody would take it over, and I started doing some career changes. So I was going to Rice Tech, which was a section of Rice University.
Right.
And I just had to quit leading that meeting because I was busy on Fridays. But, you know, it was a good thing while it lasted. People had a lot of fun, and it worked. It was a great meeting. I had a great time, and the people that I worked with there seemed to like it too.
There seems to be more of an inflow with Chris R. You know, his big thing was, you know, we like the meetings, but recovery is not in the discussion meeting. You're going to hear a lot of opinions, self-help program, you know, and get it off your chest at that meeting. He was pushing real literature meetings. And it seems like once you've gotten programmed for a certain period of time, you really have to go to literature-based meetings because the discussion meetings eventually will drive you insane because you don't hear a lot of programs. And that's not even the biggest part of the problem. The biggest part of the problem is you got newcomers in there that don't know the program, and they hear people spousing things that are not in the book. And they just assume because someone has gray hair and long-term sobriety that this is the AA program, and it's not even close. That's what drives me nuts. So if I go to the literature-based program, and then so it stays towards the literature, now you're going to get opinions and all that, but it's going to be based in the literature, and I find that to be the most rewarding. You get the same?
Yes. Yes. Hey, well, so what I was telling you when we first started talking is that there's only two kinds of meetings that interest me anymore, and that's a step study and a beginner's meeting.
And a newcomer, yeah.
I'll tell them in the
beginner's meeting, you know, say, you know, you'll hear 100 times, you're the most important person in the room. And I'll tell them, you're the most important person in the room besides me or unless the room catches fire.
I've been to thousands of meetings, and lots of them were discussion meetings. And when I was in early sobriety, the first 5 or 6 years I was in sobriety, I needed all this discussion meeting. Now, as I've gotten older and a little more sophisticated with this, I realized that it's really only about one thing, and it's doing the steps. When I get into meetings, they're talking about being fat, or they're talking about being unhappy, or they're talking about a job, I'm not interested in that stuff. And especially if they're people that have got 5 and 10 years. I mean, I can't give it away, so what am I supposed to do for these people? And, I mean, I hate to be mean, but I don't really.
Well, I work it this way with the new sponsor. One of the first suggestions I make to them is not to speak in the meeting until they've worked the fifth step.
It
covers a couple areas. First of all, they don't have to audition, so they're not thinking about what to say, so they can actually listen to what's being said. That's one. Two, they haven't worked the steps yet, so they can't really address the solution. All they got is the problem. I know what the problem looks like. If they have pain to get out, well, then they talk to me, their sponsor, or to another individual, which will help keep them sober, too. But the thing is once that pain goes away, and I don't know why this happens, but when you talk it out, especially new, in a room of fellow alcoholics or addicts, the pain goes away. It dissipates. You're being accepted into a new crew and a new tribe, and it gets pretty heady. You know, I like the pink cloud kind of down. You're not really doing anything,
yeah,
but you're getting it off your chest. You feel better. You're not drinking and drugging. So some of those problems are starting to abate. What I believe is that pain, when they walk in, is fuel. And if you can use that fuel to get them through the steps in a timely manner, so the 24 hours getting them through the steps is not an absurd, abstract concept. It works, and it works really well if you really want to be dedicated. Now, you don't have to do it in 24 hours, but I would suggest within a couple weeks is a reasonable amount of time to get them through the steps and get them working with the new alcoholic. That's their insurance. That's what I've discovered.
I have to agree. I agree with you there. And another thing I tell people that are new in the program anymore is partner up with somebody. Find another new guy. You guys go to meetings, and you fight about this, and you talk about this, and you don't buy into it until you're thoroughly convinced. And you need to talk it out with somebody. But find somebody new so that y'all won't get tired of each other. And I said, if that guy drinks, find another guy, and take that guy to meetings with you, you know, and then you can split the gas, and you can split the cost, and y'all can go have coffee afterwards. Because you need to be doing this every day for a long time, so you might as well pal up with somebody and take it around town.
That's a great idea.
We're done?
Unless you had something else. Go ahead. If you got something
I was just going to say one thing, and that was that when I first started in AA, I was working all around town. Now I travel all around the world, but at the time I was just traveling around town a lot. And what I decided was that I needed to be able to go to meetings all during the day. So the city of Houston is in a thing called Key Map, and the meeting directory is keyed to the Key Map page. So if you know where you are in the map book, you can find the meetings that are in that area. So I would be in all different parts of town working, and I would just pull out the map book and then pull out the meeting guide and go catch a new meeting somewhere. And I went all over town doing that, and I had a great time with it. It was a good experience. Got to hear a lot of
people. Making different meetings. My first sponsor, when I was late to a meeting, I was supposed to meet him, and I was running about 10 minutes late, and he goes, he called me, where were you? We were supposed to meet at the meeting. I said, well, I was running late, and I didn't want to walk into the meeting late. Yeah, I said, I didn't want to disrespect the meeting, and, you know, I got this whole litany of reasons not to do something. He says, you don't get it. He said, the only meeting you're ever late for is your first meeting. He says, as long as you make it to the closing prayer, you're right on time.
That's right.
And that has served me well over the years.
I like that.
I intentionally get late, but if I'm running late and I'm close, I go in. And I've made right to the closing prayer. You know what? I needed that prayer. Or I heard the last share, and I needed to hear that last share. So God works. That's how God works in my life sometimes. I don't really expect it, but if I do certain things happen. So, well, thank you so much, Vic. It's been an interesting conversation. Thank you for your time and for your service.
Thank you for inviting me. I had a great time talking to you guys, and I hope we've convinced somebody to keep coming back.
I hope so, too. Harold, do you have any last words?
Well, I really enjoy the idea of palling up with someone, sharing the gas, having coffee afterward. Some of my favorite meetings are the meetings after the meetings. So thanks for sharing that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, in closing, I like to say Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi. We're very popular in Nepal. You know why? You guys know why we're popular in Nepal? Huh?
No.
They like our yak. We're in 2,800 towns, cities, and villages, and between 300 and 400 to the website. Take a little over 4 years, but it continues to go out. to some people, love it. There's a few that have a hard time with it. Nobody's ever really quite done it this way before. But if you all the people who don't like it, don't look at it. If you look at it, you'll like it. There's nothing in there. And I've had big book thumpers from Distraction go through it with a fine-tooth comb and couldn't find one thing that they would disagree with. That's not either in the big book or the 12 and 12 of regular program literature, because we don't need anything else. It's all right there. We grow from there, but the basic of that information is made available to you. So you remember, so if you're looking for sponsorship information, something to hold on to in that cold night, I have one sponsee. Well, he just came into town, Dan. He's not my sponsee anymore, but I took him through the steps. He was a chronic relapser. Every time he comes into town, he takes me out to dinner. I think, what did he spend on dinner with? Like $150. I mean, it's, well, let me pay some of this. No. He's that appreciative that I took him through the steps. I don't ask him. I offered to pay, but I enjoy his company. But remember, and they do this in New Jersey. You're going to like this, Vic, right? In New Jersey, in the AA pamphlet, it suggests that you don't sponsor for a year. Did you know that?
Okay.
It's in the AA pamphlet.
Yeah.
How crazy is that? That's insane. Where they got it, it's in the AA pamphlet. You're not supposed to, they suggest not to sponsor for a year. And so what happens is sponsors start taking guys through at a step a month. That's where that comes from. So this way in a year's time, you're ready to sponsor. That's BS. So what they did in New Jersey...
Right?
So what they did in New Jersey, they took it to the next level. You had to go to meetings for a year before you did the steps, and then you did the steps at a step study because the word sponsor is not in the big book. How crazy is that? Is that insane?
Well, I just hope some of those people survive long enough. If I hadn't gotten busy with the steps pretty quickly, I don't know if I'd have made it,
We lose a lot,
Within 90 days, I was on it, and I don't know if I could have lived if I waited any longer than that.
We lose
That's
a lot.
The point.
We lose a lot. The thing is, we don't hear from the people we lose. We don't have communication with the dead. We can't cook up to the cemetery. We hear the people that are alive, and they made it. However, they made it, and some make it just by sheer force of will, and they stayed sober. They're still crazy, but they're sober, right? And so we hear from them and say, who are you to tell us how this works? We hear from those guys. We don't hear from the ones who died because they didn't take a timely approach to working the 12 steps, which is the key. Can thorough rob timely? Timely is the key on this thing. They knew that from the beginning. Timely was the key.
Yeah.
That's what they figured it out, and we've lost that, dragging this thing out, like somehow by making it longer, it's going to be more productive, and it's not. It's less productive. So
I have to agree with you.
That's the stuff we have on Rum Radio and rumradio.org. So, insane, if you're looking for sponsorship, remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.